Welcome to the second hour's readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is April, reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Sunday, May 17, 2020. Obituaries. B.J. Lovell. B.J. Lovell, 97, of Midland, passed away on Wednesday, May 6, 2020. Celebration of life will be held on Thursday, May 21, 2020, at 1 p.m. at Nally Picklin Welch Chapel in Midland, Texas. B.J. was born to Lena and Clarence Lovell in Henrietta, Texas, on August 22, 1922. He proudly served his country in the U.S. Marine Corps during World War II in the Pacific Theater. After the war, he began a 40-year career in the oil fields of West Texas. He met his wife, Hazel Meeks, in Tahoka, Texas, and they married August 25, 1945, and enjoyed 71 years together. Some of his favorite times were fishing and boating with his family at his house at Lake Proctor. He loved learning new things and was always reading. He loved to piddle in his backyard and feed pecans to doves. One dove became tame enough to land on BJ's head when it wanted more pecans. He is survived by his wife Hazel and children Mike Lovell, Cynthia, Danny Lovell, Marva, and daughter-in-law Chris Lovell. He is also survived by his grandchildren Ryan Lovell, Hillary, Amber Lovell, Dana Botros, Jonathan, Dustin Lovell, Amanda, Angela Mercury, Nick, 9 great-grandchildren, and numerous nieces and nephews. He is preceded in death by his parents, siblings, Eugene Lovell, Howard Lovell, Tommy Lovell, and Lorene Clother. He is also preceded in death by his son, Jim Lovell, and one great-grandchild. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests memorials be donated to Wounded Warrior Project, https://www.woundedwarriorproject.org, John F. Younger Alzheimer's Center, 2208 North Loop 250 West, Midland, Texas, 79707, or a patriotic charity of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Haney Atia. Former longtime Midlander Haney Atia died peacefully in his sleep May 3, 2020, at his home in Shawnee, Oklahoma. He was born December 23, 1927, in Holdenville, Oklahoma, to Shaheen and Nell Atia. In 1945, Haney graduated from Seminole, Oklahoma High School, where he participated in football, baseball, and basketball. Haney worked as a fireman in Seminole after graduation and later served in the U.S. Navy aboard the hospital ship Benevolence, deployed to China late in World War II. After serving his country, Haney returned to Seminole and married Dolores Poppy Harris. He moved to West Texas and began his long career in the oil business, employed in sales by Jones and Laughlin Pipe and Supply. Like many others, the family moved around West Texas, living in Anson, Ballinger, Midland, Snyder, Borger, and finally back to Midland in the mid-60s. Haney later went independent, opening Haney Pipe and Supply in the late 70s. He was a one-man company and knew just about everyone in the Permian Basin. Like many other West Texas oilmen, Haney was a classic example of a self-made man who lived the American dream. Haney was a huge sports fan and an avid golfer. He belonged to Ranchland Hills Country Club for many years, playing with his good friends Bob Reich, Bob Harrell, Jimmy Brock, and many others. He was known to occasionally put a dollar down on a football game or a game of gin. Haney was very proud of his Lebanese ancestry, growing up very poor in a tiny house with his parents and 9 siblings. The only thing the family had in abundance was love. He was preceded in death by his parents, his first wife Poppy Atia, a son Joe Atia, brothers Johnny Brown and Hammond Atia, 3 sisters Betty Atia, Zakia Pease, and Norma Murray. Haney is survived by his wife Sonia Atia of New Braunfels, Texas, a son Don, Janet Atia of Deadwood, South Dakota, brothers Freed, Pat Atia, and Doug, Judy Atia of Seminole, Oklahoma, sisters Shirlene Pratka and Joanne Howell of Prague, Oklahoma, and many nieces and nephews. Graveside services were conducted by Swearingen Funeral Home in Seminole, Oklahoma, on May 9, 2020. Hewell Ham. Hewell Ham was born in Lorain, Louisiana, to Huey and Ledusky Black Ham on August 6, 1932, and passed away on May 11, 2020 in Houston, Texas. He is survived by his beloved wife of 24 years, Jean Scarborough Ham of Houston, Texas, daughter Lauren Ham Aldridge and her husband Craig of Midland, Texas, son Bill and his wife Tressie of Lafayette, Louisiana, and son Scott and his wife Sarah Louise of New Orleans, Louisiana. 5 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren, and Jean's daughter Kate Drury and her husband Matt, her daughter Kimberly Husted and her husband James, and 4 great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents and brother Floyd Ham. Huell's family moved to Farmerville, Louisiana when he was 5 years old, where he lived until he graduated from Farmerville High School. He always looked forward to Christmas, and his mother made it very special, just as he did for his children. As a child, he was fond of riding his horse, which he and his brother also used to plow the fields around his home. He lived on a farm where his family raised chickens, hogs, and cattle. His mother served so much chicken to him as a child that he never ever ate poultry as an adult. This was always a fun topic at Thanksgiving. His family also had a watermelon patch, trees with grapevines, and wild blackberries and dewberries that grew in abundance. His mother made good use of everything, and they truly lived off the land. Huell was well known for his love of sports, and in high school he played football, baseball, basketball, and was a boxer. One of his favorite memories was traveling with his father to St. Louis to watch what he called Big League Baseball, where he saw many of the great ones play. His father owned a lumber mill and was a trucking contractor, so Huell worked in the lumber mill in high school, where he learned to drive big trucks and tractors. His job there earned him his first car from his father, a 1948 Fleetmaster convertible Chevrolet. He used to tell his children that it was black, and he was looking good. They feel certain he was looking good. Huell attended Louisiana State University, where he was a member of Lambda Chi Alpha fraternity. While at LSU, he thoroughly enjoyed attending the games in Tiger Stadium, and he became a lifelong Tiger fan. While at LSU, he joined the ROTC because he could substitute ROTC for PE courses. He graduated from Louisiana Tech, attended graduate school at LSU, received his commission as a second lieutenant in the United States Air Force in August of 1954, and reported for active duty in June of 1955. Huell entered the USAF at Lackland, AFB in San Antonio, Texas, attended primary pilot training in Bainbridge, Georgia, and basic pilot jet school in Laredo, Texas, where he graduated and earned his wings in August of 1956. He loved flying all types of aircraft and had the opportunity to fly 2 jet fighter bombers, the F-84F and the F-100D. His favorite was his beloved F-100, which he flew from California and Hawaii to Japan and many other overseas destinations. He was particularly fond of participating in firepower demonstrations at Elgin Air Force Base and being a good enough pilot to fly in the 615th Tactical Fighter Squadron. He served in the United States Air Force until 1959. After he left active duty, he continued to fly for an additional 8 years in the Air Force Reserves, where he flew the C-119. While flying that aircraft, he was awarded the Armed Forces Expeditionary Service Medal. He received his retirement from the USAF with the rank of major after flying for over 12 years. Huell began in the oil field drilling fluids business in 1959 in Garden City, Louisiana, and he continued in this business until 2016. His career took him to Lafayette, Louisiana, New Orleans, Louisiana, Midland, Texas, Houston, Texas, and Denver, Colorado. He was well respected in his field and loved his work. Many of his customers became lifelong friends. Huell took pleasure in playing golf, hunting, fishing, boiling crawfish, barbecuing, and watching LSU football, the Astros, and the Western Channel. His beef jerky is legendary. His career in the drilling fluids business required that he spend much of his time entertaining his customers. He excelled in this area. Huell was quite the storyteller, which made his stories of the oil business and his travels both in the Air Force and his civilian career fascinating entertainment for his family on many occasions. In the last few years, he really opened up and told us many new tales of his escapades around the world. His travels in these 2 careers took him to 5 continents. Several years ago, Huell was asked to tell his children what he was most proud of in his life, and his reply was, "Getting my Air Force wings, being successful with the service company, and #1 is raising 3 great children." He was 1 great American, 1 great man, 1 great husband, and 1 great father. We will miss you. and the fine example you set as a person, a husband, and a father will be forever with us. You can rest in peace knowing that you successfully fulfilled your mission. The family will hold a private celebration of his life at a time to be determined. John G. Haney, Mopar Man, born June 2, 1967 in Big Spring, Texas, grew up on the farm in Lomax, Texas. He went to school in Stanton, Texas. John lived his entire life on the farm. He left us to a better place on May 12, 2020, after a battle with cancer at the age of 52. John was a kind soul, loved his God, family, friends, and the SPA Church. He loved the things of old. Thus, at the age of 15, he got his first 1959 Dodge four-door car, which led to collecting old cars, Chrysler Dodge, Plymouths, where he earned the nickname Mopar Man. He had many, many cars, parts, manuals, and had a vast knowledge of all the cars of the 1920s through 1960s. If anyone needed parts or a car, John either had it or knew where it could be found. It was his passion. He goes to join his dad, Strawberry, mom, Joan, sister, Margaret, in the afterlife. Leaves behind brothers, Howard, Travis, and Paul, four nieces and one nephew. In lieu of flowers, family would like donations to Hospice of Midland for the wonderful help they provided to John and his family. Service was held Saturday, May 16, 2020, at 3 p.m. at Rest Haven North Chapel. Joseph Arthur Art Shepherd Jr. Joseph Arthur Art Shepherd Jr., 80, a most benevolent gentleman, passed away from a long-fought cardiopulmonary condition on May 6, 2020, at home with his family by his side. He was laid to rest in his hometown of Burnet, Texas, this week during a private graveside service. To echo the words of the St. David's Episcopal Church rector in Austin, Art was involved in more service roles during his life than we will ever truly know. He followed in the footsteps of his father, the late Dr. Joseph Arthur Shepherd, Sr., a country doctor and cattle rancher, founder of Shepherd Memorial Hospital in Burnet, the Camp Longhorn physician for its first 50 years of existence, and mayor of the city of Burnet for 18 years. Art was predeceased by his father, his beloved mother, Regina Black Shepherd, and his sisters, Vera Jo and Suzanne. He is survived by his cherished wife of 60 years, Martha Davis Shepherd, and his two sons and their families, Ben, Jane, and Eleanor Shepherd of Austin, and Joseph Arthur Trey Shepherd III, and his sons, Wyatt and Wesley, of Burnet. Art also leaves his stepmother, Epiphania Fanny Shepherd of Burnet, and two siblings and their families, Juan, Ann, Jose, and Mateo Shepherd of Austin, and Maria Shepherd Walker and her children, Sophia and Houston, of Dallas. More than 75 additional and close Shepherd relatives survive Art across central Texas and throughout the state. Art was born in Burnet on August 20, 1939, and grew up in the historic Civil War-era home on the Rocky Rest Ranch. He recalled fondly a childhood spent riding his horse 3 miles to visit his best friend on the neighboring ranch because bicycles were dangerous, his father said. One of 13 shepherds to board at St. Stephen's Episcopal School in Austin, Art, however, left Austin his junior year to attend the Sewanee Military Academy, as it was known then, in Tennessee. At Sewanee, Art was named as captain of the baseball team, elected president of the Sewanee Cotillion, and played varsity football. In 1958, Art entered the University of Texas, Austin, where he earned a bachelor's degree in accounting. He would serve as a licensed, certified public accountant for over 50 years. At the university, he joined the Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity and received the Best Pledge Award his freshman year. Art was committed to his fraternity, fulfilling the duties of vice president of recruitment his senior year and the chapter alumni advisor for 25 years. During those summers between college terms, he worked as a counselor at Camp Longhorn, following his 7 years as a camper. Art was quite the trick water skier and worked as the camp's director of water skiing as well. Between college and camp, Art found time, as his father's direction most likely, to run cattle on the family ranches in Burnet and Chihuahua, Mexico. During college, Art was at the Abilene Country Club pool with friends one summer when he met a beautiful lifeguard, Bonnie Martha Davis. Luckily for Art, he learned that Martha would be returning to the University of Texas in the fall. They were married that next summer in Abilene on Art's birthday and returned to Austin for Art's last year of university. Settling their two sons in West Austin in the late 1960s after several years in Houston, Art and Martha quickly became involved in their church and community. Art found his true calling as a Little League coach, leading both Ben and Trey's Little League teams, including the much ballyhooed 7-Up, Stripling Blake, and Amkin Construction teams. Art recently recounted a story about the opening of what is today known as Brumley Field at WAYA. The night before the field's official opening, a handful of coaches, Art included, noticed a small problem. The outfield lacked a back fence. Art and his fellow Little League moms and dads put up a makeshift fence along the outfield that very night, using only one nail at the top of each board to speed the process and finish by morning. Martha and Art spent any remaining spare time with their sons hunting in South Texas and camping in Colorado. As the boys grew out of Little League, Martha and Art purchased a second home on Lake Travis. Shortly thereafter, they purchased the Dodd Street Docks Marina, also on Lake Travis, which they owned for 30 years. Art ventured that they chose Lake Travis because Lake Austin had gotten too crowded by 1970. The family enjoyed many an evening at the lake house, but nearly 20 years ago, Art and Martha turned sail for the Gulf, acquiring a weekend home in Port Aransas and learning the art of saltwater fishing. Art fished seriously and also loved taking his grandchildren on shorter excursions, once explaining to a concerned little shepherd that the fishies are just going to sleep once off the hook and on the boat. Art was immensely proud of his three grandchildren, and when health allowed, could be found among the faithful at his grandson's football games in Burnet and his granddaughter's ballet recitals in Midland. Art's anchor on and off the water was his faith. Art never said no when asked to serve on a finance committee or the vestry at St. David's Episcopal Church. He and Martha were faithful supporters of the church's Next to New ministry and store, which has been one of their volunteer priorities since its inception. The Shepherd family feels a tremendous loss with Art's passing, and yet also can rejoice in his complete healing and eternal life in heaven. In remembrance, the family suggests a donation to the St. David's Episcopal Church Foundation, 301 East 8th Street, Austin, Texas, 78701, or the West Austin Youth Association, 1314 Exposition Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78703, www.waya.org/donate. Remembrances may be shared at www.wcfish.com. Arrangements by Weed Corley Fish Funeral Home, Austin, Texas, 512-452-8811. Sharon Juanice Lewis. Sharon Juanice Lewis passed from this life and entered eternal rest on Saturday, May 9, 2020, following a brief illness. Sharon was born April 3, 1952, in Midland, Texas, to Earl Lewis and Lula Parks Lewis, and attended public schools in Midland, graduating from Midland High School in 1970. Following graduation, she traveled to Portales, New Mexico, and continued her studies at Eastern New Mexico University, graduating in 1974 with the degree of Bachelor of Science, Honors in Sociology. Sharon continued her pursuit of knowledge at Arizona State University and earned the degree of Master of Social Work in 1976. Sharon enjoyed a 10-year career as a social worker for the Texas Department of Human Services in Midland, serving the aged and disabled community who required the health care services of skilled nursing facilities. Following her retirement, Sharon continued to serve and support her community and circle of family and friends. For the past 5 years, her advocacy expanded as she served as president of the nonprofit corporation Free Will Advocates of Midland, Texas. Sharon shared her gift of wisdom and passion for writing by publishing her first book, Orange Heart Thoughts, in 2017. Sharon's legacy is her faith in Jesus, heart of wisdom, gracious devotion to family and friends, infectious humor, zest for celebrating moments, and gleeful enjoyment of great music, nature, seasons, delicious food, professional football, and good movies. Sharon was preceded in death by her parents, Earl and Lula Lewis, sister Marilyn Lewis, and brother Jason Lewis. Sharon is survived by her brother, Larry Lewis, and his wife, Phyllis, and sister Trina Lewis, all of Midland, nieces Miracle Dorn of Midland, and Chloe Lewis and Candace Lewis, both of Austin. Sharon is cherished by a host of loving family and friends. Sharon's family has honored her request for a private interment. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Death notices. Christine Diane Marks Bailey. Christine Diane Marks Bailey, 62, of Gardendale, passed away May 14, 2020, in Gardendale, Texas. No services have been scheduled at this time. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory. Faye Daugherty. Faye Daugherty passed away on April 14, 2020. Services will be held on June 1, 2020 at 11 a.m. in the chapel of First Baptist Church.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Sunday, May 17th, 2020. Obituaries for Sunday, May 17th. Keith Stewart Bailey. Keith Stewart Bailey of Odessa passed away May 10th, just 3 days after his 92nd birthday. His ashes, along with the ashes of Noveline Gwendolyn Bailey, the love of his life and mother of his children, who had passed away on the first anniversary of 9/11, will be spread together during a future memorial ceremony. Keith was born in Big Spring, May 7th, 1928, to Niall and Lena Bailey. Keith is survived by his son, Bobby Bailey, and wife, Debbie, both of Odessa, sister Mary Shanks of San Angelo, brother Roy Bailey of Big Spring, sister Nyla Allen of Big Spring, two grandchildren and two great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his wife, Noveline, son Mickey Stewart Bailey, brother Ewell Bailey, and sister Mona Blackwell, along with his parents, Lena and Niall Bailey. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to First United Methodist Church of Odessa. Whitford Eugene Parnell. W.E. Parnell, 81, of Odessa, passed away May 8th at his home. He was born June 18, 1938, to Ray Parnell and Catherine Ashburn in Stanford. W.E. is survived by his daughter, Mitzi Cavender of Odessa, his son, Tony Parnell of Odessa, brothers Ben Parnell of Hawley and Joe Parnell of Swansea, Illinois, a granddaughter, as well as Ryan Parnell of Odessa. He also is survived by great-grandchildren. Services will be at 1 p.m. at Sunset Memorial Garden, Monday, May 18th at 1 p.m. with Reverend Larry Hood officiating. To send family condolences, please sign his guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. Carol Ann Hammett Ford. Carol Ann Ford, 82, of Odessa, passed away Thursday, May 14th. She was born April 10th, 1938, near Rotan, to Lester and Ira Dean Hammett. She married Doyle Ford in Lubbock in 1961. Surviving her are her son, Steve Ford, and wife, Hope of Odessa, daughter, Paula Rutherford, two grandchildren, her brother, David Hammett, and wife, Debbie of Madisonville, sisters, Maribeth Giller and husband, Larry of Brazoria, and Mary Delenis of Bosque Farms, New Mexico, as well as many nieces and nephews. Carol is preceded in death by her husband, Doyle E. Ford, an infant child, Blake Ford, who passed away at birth, her parents, Lester and Ira Dean Hammett, brothers Earl Dean Hammett and wife Patty, and Landon and Radell Hammett, sisters Valinda Perryman and Peggy Walker, two infant brothers, and her brothers-in-law, Bill DeLianis and John Henderson. Visitation will be held Tuesday, May 19th from 5 to 8 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home in Midland. A funeral service will be held Wednesday, May 20th at 10 a.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home. Burial will immediately follow at American Heritage Cemetery with Pastor Doug Herget officiating. Death notice. Betty Ora Knott. Betty Ora Knott, 71, of Odessa, died Saturday, May 2nd. A graveside service is scheduled for 11 a.m. Monday, May 18th at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Hubbard Kelly Funeral of Odessa.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Sunday, May 17th, 2020. Guest View: Obscure Law for a Potential Coronavirus Vaccine by John T. Preston. According to the Milken Institute, over 70 treatments for COVID-19 are already in clinical trials or progressing toward clinical trials. Several of the inventions behind this flurry of activity resulted from government-funded research in U.S. universities. This public-private cooperation is our best hope of defeating the virus. It's also the foundation of our entire drug development system. And it wouldn't be possible without an obscure law known as the Bayh-Dole Act. For 40 years, this bipartisan policy has allowed university and nonprofit researchers to retain ownership of patents that result from federally funded research, and then license those patents to private sector companies that have the resources to turn good ideas into viable products. The law has delivered an incredible return on taxpayers' investment. American research universities' patent awards have risen steadily over the last four decades, increasing from just 390 in 1980 to nearly 7,500 in 2017. Bayh-Dole has contributed over $1 trillion to America's economic output and has supported 4 million jobs and more than 11,000 startups. It'd be hugely counterproductive to weaken the law, as some politicians have urged. Before Bayh-Dole, the government retained ownership of the patents resulting from federally funded research. For instance, if the National Institutes of Health funded research into a protein at a university lab, and then university scientists patented that finding, the government would own the patent. In theory, this ensured that taxpayers would receive any royalties for patents the government subsequently licensed out to companies. But in practice, the federal government did a terrible job of licensing patents to private firms, who could then turn the findings into commercial products. Prior to Bayh-Dole, just 5% of government-owned patents were ever licensed to the private sector. In short, Bayh-Dole has kept federally funded research from going to waste. My time at MIT showed me the caliber of innovation that can occur when inventors can retain ownership of patents. Just look at high-definition television, a relatively recent invention, and the result of both federal support and private sector risk-taking. Controlled-release drug technology was another groundbreaking invention developed during my time at MIT. Controlled-release technology makes possible such life-altering devices as drug-eluting stents that unblock arteries and long-lasting birth control implants. Despite the law's myriad successes, some lawmakers have proposed weakening it. They want to allow the government to march in and seize patents on technologies or medicines they feel are overpriced. Though their motives, seeking to make medicines and other products cheaper for consumers, are understandable, their scheme would backfire horribly. Drug companies spent a combined $180 billion on research and development in 2018. That sum dwarfs the National Institute of Health's current annual spending of roughly $42 billion. Firms would stop spending such sums if the government could arbitrarily seize the final products that result from years or decades of additional R&D. The pace of innovation would slow considerably. By facilitating closer cooperation between university scientists and the private sector, Bayh-Dole has paved the way for technologies Americans could only dream of a few decades ago. It's our best chance for a coronavirus cure. Tampering with the law makes no sense at all. John T. Preston is former director of technology licensing at MIT and founder of TEM Capital. John T. Preston. Guest View, Rural Location Should Not Prevent Help, by Jonathan Flodick. While states are beginning to reopen in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, businesses are still hurting. They will be for some time. The Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security, CARES, CARES Act, passed by Congress in March, was a good first step in helping businesses overcome economic challenges. Under the plan, the Small Business Administration, SBA, is paying all loans owed to agency lenders, including principal, interest, and fee payments, for 6 months. This allows business owners to use money set aside for their loan payment to meet payroll, cover utilities, and manage unexpected costs. Unfortunately, this relief effort left out small rural businesses with loans through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, Rural Micro Entrepreneur Assistance Program, RMAP. The Center for Rural Affairs has joined 64 other small business lenders in asking federal lawmakers to offer rural entrepreneurs an equal opportunity by including these same provisions in future legislation for business owners with RMAP loans. Businesses with loans through RMAP have 10 or fewer employees, are located in a rural area, and have been unable to secure funding through the SBA due to an absence of local lenders or a lack of credit. Many are in the service industry, retail, restaurants, and salons, and are especially vulnerable today. This policy has the potential to keep more than 1,000 entrepreneurs in business, real men and women on the streets of rural America who deserve to be treated equally. We urge Congress to move swiftly and address this oversight in any forthcoming legislation. Jonathan Lodick is policy director of the Center for Rural Affairs, established in 1973. The Center for Rural Affairs is a private nonprofit organization working to strengthen small businesses, family farms and ranches, and rural communities through action-oriented programs addressing social, economic, and environmental. Guest View, Rural Location Should Not Prevent Help, by Jonathan Flodick. While states are beginning to reopen in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, businesses are still hurting. They will be for some time. The Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security, CARES, CARES Act, passed by Congress in March, was a good first step in helping businesses overcome economic challenges. Under the plan, the Small Business Administration, SBA, is paying all loans owed to agency lenders, including principal, interest, and fee payments, for 6 months. This allows business owners to use money set aside for their loan payment to meet payroll, cover utilities, and manage unexpected costs. Unfortunately, this relief effort left out small rural businesses with loans through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, Rural Micro Entrepreneur Assistance Program, RMAP. The Center for Rural Affairs has joined 64 other small business lenders in asking federal lawmakers to offer rural entrepreneurs an equal opportunity by including these same provisions in future legislation for business owners with RMAP loans. Businesses with loans through RMAP have 10 or fewer employees, are located in a rural area, and have been unable to secure funding through the SBA due to an absence of local lenders or a lack of credit. Many are in the service industry, retail, restaurants, and salons, and are especially vulnerable today. This policy has the potential to keep more than 1,000 entrepreneurs in business, real men and women on the streets of rural America who deserve to be treated equally. We urge Congress to move swiftly and address this oversight in any forthcoming legislation. Jonathan Lodick is policy director of the Center for Rural Affairs, established in 1973. The Center for Rural Affairs is a private nonprofit organization working to strengthen small businesses, family farms and ranches, and rural communities through action-oriented programs addressing social, economic, and environmental.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Sunday, May 17th, 2020. Service companies hopeful despite loss of jobs and activity. By Nella McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. The brakes got thrown very quickly, said Matt Raglan, president of Wellworks Energy, of the economic downturn enveloping the energy industry. Raglan said in a phone interview that he began his oil industry career in 1985, the same year his father was ending a 35-year career with Standard Oil of Ohio, which had been purchased by BP. He never worried about his job. The people got raises every year. The companies took care of their people, Raglan said. Then came the oil crunch of the 1980s, the worst I'd ever seen. That was OPEC trying to grab market share. Unlike this, it was a slow death. People thought OPEC would come around. People tried to hold on. Death took place over years. Recovery took place over years. The 2008-2009 downturn was a quick death brought on by the banking crisis. It was a quick death, much like we're seeing here, but a quick recovery. I'm hoping for a 2008-2009 type scenario as opposed to the 1985-86 scenario. Leslie Beyer, president of the Petroleum Equipment and Services Association, told the Reporter-Telegram by email that the U.S. oil field services sector has lost more than 66,000 jobs since the coronavirus pandemic began. She also said job losses are likely to continue as producers reduce capital expenditures and production. There will also be a significant amount of consolidation in the sector in the second half of 2020, she said. Digitalization and automation efforts will accelerate, and remote work and learning could be incorporated on a much larger scale than before the pandemic. In the downturn of the 80s, there was so much carnage, said Raglan. I'm already seeing carnage, layoffs, rigs going down. To me, always the saddest part is the effect on people. As the acute impact on both supply from the price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia and demand from the COVID-19 pandemic, factors hit the oilfield services sector simultaneously. PISA shifted its focus immediately by creating remote forums for sharing best operational, health, and safety practices in the COVID-19 environment. Bringing people together is one of the most important things PISA does, and we've continued to do that throughout the downturn. So far, PISA has hosted 30 remote events, and we have much more on the schedule. Her association has created a COVID-19 resources clearinghouse covering nearly 4 dozen topics that are updated regularly. These resources include best practices, essential documentation, information on legislation and guidance, updates on accessing Small Business Administration, stimulus programs, and policy recommendations to help the OFS sector. The association also prioritized quickly communicating the latest information, announcements, and orders from federal, state, and local governments, and advocating for OFS sector interests.
policy makers. To keep pace with the deluge of information, PISA is publishing a weekly newsletter with near real-time updates. In addition, we've maintained focus on long-term priorities. For example, we recently launched an ESG Center of Excellence, an online repository of information and resources to help members keep environment, social, and governance considerations at the forefront of their thinking as they manage the current crisis. Raglan said that in 3 or 4 months, oil prices could creep up, perhaps to the mid-30s, and then activity will creep up. Oil that has been in storage will be drawn down, and then wells that have been shut in or that are drilled but not completed will be brought online first. Ramping up drilling activity will take longer. What gives him hope is seeing the amount of oil production that has been taken off the market in response to conditions. He said he's pleased to see the operators aggressively attempting to remove the excess supplies from the market. WellWorks has seen a significant reduction in sales and service, so the company has taken the opportunity to focus on finishing the products it has under development. Some of the things we're doing, they're all around artificial lift, but they're very innovative. I'm pleased with what we're introducing into the market. The oilfield service sector will continue its focus on innovation and become a critical player as the industry maintains its efforts toward carbon management. The companies investing in technology, innovation, and energy efficiency will be best positioned to succeed post-pandemic. The innovative spirit of the oil field services and equipment sector drove the boom in shale oil and will lead the energy industry to a lower carbon future. The oil and gas industry currently is playing a critical role in combating the virus. In addition to providing affordable energy in homes and hospitals, chemicals derived from petroleum are essential ingredients in the medications, equipment, and machines used to treat patients and protect healthcare workers from infection. Like Raglan, Bayer said her organization is already starting to see some market positivity around reduced supply because of the need of shut-in activity and voluntary proration. Demand will rise once our communities begin to emerge from quarantine environments. When these factors begin to take hold, the world will need more energy. Oil and natural gas will be a strong part of the energy mix for decades to come. Times are difficult now, and we're going to see permanent changes to the way society operates, but we'll also need to be innovative solutions that can only be provided by men and women of the OFS sector, who are in the heart of the energy industry's technology. The opinion page. Guest view from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. President, Congress must control nation's soaring federal debt. The country was steamrolled by the coronavirus, and the economic stimulus packages to help businesses and individuals have been staggering in costs. Admittedly, the aid was necessary, but it has left the nation with a mammoth $3.7 trillion deficit. Before further stimulus packages are passed by Congress and signed by President Donald Trump, those leaders should commit to whittling down the nation's $24 trillion in total debt, starting with the next federal budget, which begins October 1st. Focusing on the U.S. debt at a time when tens of thousands of Americans are dying or lost their jobs because of the coronavirus might seem petty and irrelevant, but the unchecked spending in the past 2 months to counter the economic impact of the disease is alarming. $1 trillion in COVID-19 stimulus aid already passed, and considerably more is being discussed by congressional leaders, will push this year's federal deficit to $3.7 trillion,
That's the level of spending this year that exceeds the amount of revenue collected in U.S. taxes and fees. Not since the end of World War II has the nation's deficit as a share of the main economic measure, the gross domestic product, risen so fast and so high. The Congressional Budget Office projects this fiscal year's deficit will amount to nearly 19% of the GDP. And the Nonpartisan Committee for Responsible Federal Budget Projects total U.S. debt will be 101% of the GDP. The deficit proportion is twice as large as in any year since 1945. The total debt is forecast to climb to $30 trillion within 5 years, or to about $100,000 per American. Worse, the skyrocketing deficit stems not from spending that will spur growth, but from spending simply trying to restore the status quo of a few months ago. Crushing debt without growth is not a best practice. The lofty spending does not pose an immediate problem, as the Federal Reserve has lowered interest rates so it can borrow money by paying almost no interest. But tamed inflation will not last forever, and rising inflation would increase the country's borrowing costs. And many economists maintain that high government debt curbs private investment, and that harms economic growth. As the pandemic unfolded in March across the United States, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin told the Washington Post, "Interest rates are incredibly low, so there's very little cost to borrowing this money. In different times, we'll fix the deficit. This is not the time to worry about it." We disagree. Getting spending under control is critical and should be a foremost priority as Trump and Congress put together the next fiscal year budget, as some leaders are expected to push for huge programs, often without funding. Deficit hawks in Congress must vocally build support to corral the 2020-21 budget. Balanced federal budgets, sadly, disappeared in 2001. To keep the debt from becoming a burden on our children and our children's children, Congress and the President should assemble the next federal budget with a firm commitment to keep the annual deficit under $1 trillion and to adopt a plan to balance the budget within 5 years.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Sunday, May 17th, 2020. Odessa Mom, Proud of Her Grad, by Ruth Campbell. Ivory Carter, Jr. will be one of the hundreds of graduates from Permian High School, officially, on Friday. But back in August 2012, that might not have seemed possible. Almost 8 years ago, Carter, now 17, was playing at a friend's house in South Odessa. He followed a lizard through a gap in the cinder blocks along the base of the house and had an asthma attack. He was flown to Covenant Medical Center in Lubbock after being pulled out from the home at 311 Patterson Avenue. He was unresponsive and not breathing, according to an Odessa American article from August 2012. His mother, Letitia Green, said she called out to Ivory and called 911. His dad came back and pulled him out from under the house, she said. Green said Carter was in a coma for a month. She said she really is excited about Carter's graduation. Green recently purchased 2 yard signs with his photo for his room and the window of their apartment. His room is decorated with posters of superheroes like Spider-Man. Green said his favorite is Blade. "I'm really excited. I really am," Green said. "We've made it this far. We've been through a lot. I've been right there with him. He's a strong boy. I know that. He doesn't talk. He tries to, but he doesn't talk. Not yet." Carter, who is wheelchair-bound, attends school for about an hour every day taught by homebound teachers with Ector County ISD. He has nurses who care for him while Green is at work at Aramark, which provides food service facilities and uniform services to hospitals, universities, school districts, stadiums, and other businesses around the world, its website said. Green said her son really likes his teacher. He tried to sit up the other day trying to see her. He lifted his whole back up, Green said. He is doing a lot better than he did last year. He can move everything, she added. He's a lot more awake than you think. He listens to everything. Green said Carter has adapted to remote learning well. He does have a schedule that he goes by. You have to be around him to see all of that. It's not something that you can just talk about. You have to be here to see what he does. As for future plans, Green said she doesn't know yet what those will include. She wants to get a house soon with a yard so she can have him outside while she gardens. I'm a mother, Green said. Even without any money, I'm going to take care of him. Linda Rhodes Tucker, Interim Director for Special Services, congratulated Carter on his achievement. ECISD offers a wide variety of educational services, and our staff serves all students regardless of need. We all love seeing our students succeed, and we celebrate their successes and accomplishments right along with them. I would like to congratulate Ivory as well as his family for this outstanding achievement, Rhodes Tucker said in an email. To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Don't count oxygen as protection. Dear Dr. Roach, I am a 78-year-old man with severe COPD who is on oxygen 24/7. I use a portable oxygen generator when I need to go to the store or for medical appointments. Does the oxygen protect me from getting virus or flu germs, or is it more likely I will inhale them with the air and deliver it to me in my oxygen? I go out seldom and try to practice social distancing when I do. I wear latex gloves but can't wear a mask because of the cannula. JTD. Answer. Oxygen concentrators work by utilizing the unique characteristics of a mineral called zeolite. Under pressure from a compressor, the nitrogen in the atmosphere is absorbed onto the zeolite pellets in the concentrator. The resultant gas is highly concentrated oxygen and is delivered to the patient at the prescribed concentration, while the nitrogen is vented to the atmosphere when the pressure in the compressor is released. If there are virus particles in the air, they are associated with liquid, ranging from large droplets to very small ones. Very small droplets can remain in the air for long periods of time. Hours. Some viruses, such as measles, are able to remain infectious in the air for many hours, while others are more associated with larger droplets and are infectious for a much shorter time in the air. If the infectious particles are in the air, they can theoretically be passed to you through the concentrator or directly through the air that is also inhaled through the mouth and nose. Thus, with or without an oxygen concentrator, it is possible to be infected by someone close by, especially one who is coughing, which expels large amounts of infectious particles on both large and small droplets. That's why the distancing of 6 feet or more is helpful in reducing infection rates. However, severe COPD is a major risk factor for bad outcomes in respiratory infections, such as influenza or coronavirus, which is why staying away from potentially infectious people is so important.
Hello, this is Michael reading Dear Abby for Wednesday, May 20th, 2020. Woman's focus on fitness is hard for friend to bear. Dear Abby, I've been friends with Lorraine for 30 years. Actually, the friendship is kind of one-sided because she bugs the hell out of me. She's a super skinny health nut, who constantly posts health advice and uplifting mantras on social media. Her Instagram feed is filled with pictures of her bland-looking vegan food and her doing yoga poses or running 5Ks in midriff tops so we can all see her six-pack abs. She regularly donates blood plasma and posts pictures of that, too. Dining with her is embarrassing because she grills the waiters on how the food is prepared, even in vegan restaurants that list all the ingredients. She comes off, to me anyway, as thinking she has every facet of life figured out. She has been married twice to two jerks, keeps breaking up and making up with Harry, a seemingly nice guy, because he's fat, he's slightly plump yet attractive, and drinks too much. Not sure about that. Her son, whom she treated as an annoyance and inconvenience when he was young, is now a gun-toting drug dealer. I'm not perfect. I know I'm lazy, impatient, and drink too much. But I don't portray myself as otherwise. My husband, a nicer person than I am, doesn't understand my resentment of Lorraine and keeps reminding me how much she loves me. She does. We're both in our 50s, but I feel like I've outgrown our friendship. By the way, I don't think I'm jealous of her because I'm very happy in my marriage and feel that I am more attractive than she is, despite outweighing her. Must I stay friends with Lorraine? If not, how do I end it? Canceling her in Kansas City. Dear Canceling, it appears you have a love-hate relationship with Lorraine. Nothing is wrong with you, and no law says you must maintain a friendship with her. When contact becomes more of an annoyance than a pleasure, many people begin editing their circle of acquaintances. The way to end your relationship with her would be to make yourself less available when she calls or wants to get together. If she asks you why, explain that you have fewer of the same interests than you used to, while omitting the part about her six-pack abs. Dear Abby, I am a widow. My husband passed away 3 years ago after 43 years of marriage. I met a widower who was also married for 43 years. His wife passed 5 years ago. My grown children and grandchildren refuse to accept him. My therapist and psychiatrist tell me to stand my ground because I'm in love with him, and he is with me. Even my priest, who officiated at my husband's funeral, said I should consider this relationship as heaven sent. We get along beautifully, and it breaks my heart that my family wants me to choose between him or them. I am devastated over this because this is not how my family is. We are in love, and although I love my family with all of my heart, I don't think they have the right to gang up against me. May I have your opinion on this? Devastated Mother. Dear Devastated, what a painful situation. You say this isn't how your family is. Open your eyes, dear lady, and recognize that this is exactly who they are. Then open up your ears and pay attention to the psychiatrist and the therapist you are paying good money for, as well as your priest. My opinion is you must live your life, and my advice is to get on with it. Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or your favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.